Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Emma Powell, news editor. How are you doing, Emma?
Good, thank you.
Excellent. And James Norrington, how are you doing, James?
Good, thanks, John.
Excellent. You've written the cover feature this week, infrastructure, which we're going to talk about shortly.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Something we all need, something we possibly all need a little bit of in our portfolios.
To a certain extent, yeah.
To a certain extent. Well, we like to qualify things on the Investors Chronicle. Never a definitive answer. Right, let's start with news, though. Lots going on, so much so that you needed extra pages to cover the news section this week. Emma, what's the big story?
Big stories. We've had a lot of profit warnings, actually. Not very good news for companies. We should start.
Let's start with profit warnings. I mean, this is actually the context for these profit warnings is actually there have been some earnings numbers coming out from the US overnight. They've not been so great. Are we seeing a slowdown in growth?
Yes, I would say so.
Yes,
basically,
now there is a definitive answer.
Although, obviously, as we do allude to in 7 days, I think people are thinking we did have slightly better UK growth. So I think people are flagging interest rate rise in the UK.
What was it? It was
0.4%.
The expectation was 0.3% growth, and what came in was 0.4% growth, subject to revision, of course, as it always is. And that is enough to prompt talk of an interest rate rise.
Well, yeah, I mean, people think it's nailed on.
Go on, James, what are you going to say?
I was just going to say, as we are in the FT building, I ought to point out that pre-Brexit, that it would have been about 0.9 before this. So, you know, for our just eyeing a job over there, have to get in that Remainer point.
Thanks, James. Thanks for that. Anyway, so growth was slightly better than expected. Still somewhat anemic, you could argue. Certainly, as it's been frequently pointed out by our colleagues in the building, one of the lowest growth rates in the G20. Brexit is partly to blame, so they say. But company-specific stuff is not Brexit.
No.
So let's talk about some of those. What's happening? What's going wrong in the companies that we cover?
Let's take it on a case-by-case basis.
That's the only way you can take it, isn't it?
So, exactly. So, maybe let's start with Interserve. This has been a very long-running one, these problems. I would say that the problems really with Interserve, I mean, they first mentioned delays with public sector contracts and things like that, which hurt their support services division, their energy for waste contract, which they've exited. There's been a lot of problems there. Basically, provisions keep rising. And I think
that's... to build one of these things near us. Huge opposition to it.
I can imagine.
I mean, chucking rubbish into a big furnace and generating it. People didn't really like it.
No, I expect not. It hasn't worked out well for Interserve either. And they've also had some problems with their construction contracts. But really, the real kind of nub of the problem, and what's more worrying, I think, as somebody that, you know, that would hold shares in Interserve, I think would be the fact that these provisions keep rising. So the latest thing last week was they came out and have... said there'll be an additional £35 million provision for the energy for waste contract. That was on top of £160 million that he'd already taken in 2016. And more worryingly so, the net debt to adjusted cash profit ratio required by its financial covenants, they think there's a very realistic prospect that they won't meet them. So... very worrying.
Yeah, you don't want to see companies getting close to their debt covenants.
Exactly.
I mean, this takes us into, I mean, there is actually another story about from the outsourcing sector in the magazine this week, which is Carillion, which has already had its big profit warnings.
Yeah.
What we're seeing now, I mean, the shares have recovered quite sharply. In fact, I mean, amazingly enough, they appear in the top spot of Algae Stock Screen this week.
Yeah,
as an unloved value share.
Would be surprising.
It's a ratio that is developed to Zeus. It's an interesting idea. You know, he likes to think outside the box as Algae. But you look at the results of that screen, they're horrible. I mean, these companies you don't really like. Carillion's at the top. Carillion's had a nightmare. Are things bouncing back for them? Are they taking the right steps to get themselves back on
track?
They
are taking, so they did have some good news this week, obviously after, I think they've lost down about 75% this year or something. But they did have some good news. They've managed to secure some additional funding, about £140 million. They've also deferred... from their creditors.
Right.
They've also managed to, they're basically going to defer their pension contributions to their pension scheme.
That's not something that the pensioners would like to hear, you would assume?
No, I assume the trustees probably, you know, it's not ideal for them, but...
Yeah, I mean, actually, again, I'm sorry to go off on a tangent here. Pension schemes are important, especially in terms of cash flow and the ability of a company to pay dividends, which is something that Phil Oakley explores in his feature this week about high yielders and how safe those yields are.
Yeah, actually, you do have, obviously, a company has a duty to pay cash or some other way of trying to fill the deficit. But actually, there is also rules around, you know, you can't, as a pension scheme trustee, demand so much if it's going to put the company in danger. And if a company like Carillion, you know, they've had such high debt levels and it's really started to mount, there's no use of that company going under by contributions.
Presumably over the years, you know, being an outsourcer, they've taken lots of staff across from their customers on, what do they call it, two-pay, they call it, don't they?
Yeah.
And presumably they will have to honour their pension schemes, which is why I assume they have a fairly large pension obligation there.
Yeah. They've got about six that they pay into.
So quite substantial. So they are on the right tracks, but
they're
but
on
you're
the
not
right
convinced
track. But
that...
I just think again with Carillion and Interserve, it's the debt problems, and it's the fact that these, you know, they just really need to start generating cash. But there's been so many contracts that just haven't worked out for them. The costs associated with those contracts are very uncertain, and that's the worrying thing, I think. It's the uncertainty if the costs keep going up.
Well, this goes back to a conversation that we've been having for some time, and I don't think we've ever really boiled it down to an answer, which is, you know, is the idea of outsourcing, is it just broken? Is the idea actually a nice idea that doesn't work in reality? Because we've seen a lot of trouble from this sector in recent months.
Yeah, I mean, you've had Capita, you've had Mighty, Interserve, obviously... A couple of years ago, you had Serco and G4S. It's very difficult to find an outsourcer that hasn't had problems. And I think it boils down to the fact that, you know, there was this big drive amongst the public sector for people to outsource services. But at the end of the day, and even Rupert Soames, when he took over at Serco, admitted they'd been trying to win contracts at the expense of actually thinking about, is this going to make us any money? I mean, and I think it is that kind of drive to the bottom, undercutting each other to win business.
Yeah, predatory pricing, you could almost call it, which is something that Robbo talks about in his Taking Stock column this week. I mean, I've always thought, you know, if you are a public sector organisation, you provide a certain type of service, you obviously, you think you can get that done, or somebody telling you they can offer you that more cheaply, and they will take it off your hands and you spend less on, you know, whatever, picking up the bins or whatever it might be. How do they offer it, you know, more cheaply than the private sector can deliver it? I can only think there is either a degradation of service, or that the contracts have actually been underpriced and don't reflect the reality of delivering them.
Well, hence some of the problems
indeed,
that are going on
indeed.
Now, where, like Interserve, where the costs keep rising because they've obviously miscalculated the costs, haven't they?
And they don't seem to be the only ones.
No. I would say this is a sector-wide problem.
I mean, it's, you know, is it? I mean, the outsourcing sector is very broad, as you know. You used to cover it yourself.
Yeah.
Are there types of outsourcers that are safer, you would say, than others in terms of the type of service that they're providing?
Yeah, I think a lot of the problems come when you have these very broad brush outsourcers. When if you get some specialist ones, like I think we mentioned earlier, actually Johnson Service Group, which does hotel linen, because it just specialises in doing a particular service and it's good at it, then I think, you know, a lot of the issue has been, and I know that's why Serco have now kind of concentrating on the UK, is trying to, I think, spread yourself too thinly and trying to do everything, because there has been such a drive towards outsourcing.
And also doing low value stuff.
Exactly. It's very hard to compete, isn't it? How do you add value? Cleaning.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's very low margin work anyway. It's very difficult. That's why there is a drive to the bottom.
Yeah, we also like Babcock in the outsourcing sector.
Babcock, yeah, but that's because, you know, although it has come unstuck, obviously, with its Magnox contracts, where, again, that was to do with the government basically didn't assess what the cost was going to be. Although that's very difficult, you'd say, nuclear decommissioning, because the problems that could crop up are almost unknown.
It's funny you say that, because the nuclear industry is something that you mentioned in the cover feature, James, as being especially problematic as an infrastructure investment too.
It's something that some of the managed funds actually avoid, nuclear infrastructure, because the high upfront costs of it. It also has huge stranded asset risk, and all the political, the social, the ESG considerations around investing in infrastructure. It's something that's blackballed from some of the funds.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I'll just say on Babcock, the reason, even though they have had those problems with the nuclear, they also do a lot of work for the Ministry of Defence, because it's high barrier to entry, lots of recurring contracts, lots of recurring revenue. That differentiates them. That's what you need, I think.
I mean, to be fair, like on the Magnox point, you know, I mean, a company like Babcock would never be considered an infrastructure investment because it's a recurring service. They're not, basically.
They're not making money from the service rather than from owning and leasing the infrastructure itself.
Exactly. There is a job to be done in decommissioning the UK's ageing nuclear fleet. And you know, that Magnox problem was a kind of one-off.
Yeah.
And there is
yeah.
work for them there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fact this work has to be done and they need somebody that has the specialist expertise to do that. So
yeah, I mean, let's move on from outsourcing because, as I say, to my mind, it's not a sector I would invest in. Absolutely no way.
Yeah, it's very risky.
Very risky. I think you know you've got to. I think you're essentially playing and catching the cycle in that sector. But there have been some more worrying warnings from what you would consider more reliable companies. I'm looking at Unilever here specifically.
Yes, Unilever. Well, there's kind of two strands to this. One is they've actually just announced today that they're unconditionally buying back Dutch preference shares. So there are some rumours that they may reconsider their dual-headed structure. So they may just list in London or just list in the Netherlands.
Oh my goodness, I presume speculation will abound as to which way they ultimately decide to go.
Well, yeah, exactly. But also, I think the thing with Unilever that's really been hurting them is their developed market sales have been not great.
We've kind of alluded to this recently in terms of private label booming, as it were. We have recently tipped McBride, for example, which makes private label personal and household goods, cleaning products. Are we seeing consumers starting to trade down?
Well, it's funny you mention McBride because there is a tip update in this week's magazine.
Oh, fancy that!
Which I wrote, in fact.
So tell me about McBride. I mean, yes. What are we seeing here? Are these two sides of the same story?
Well, again, they did experience a bit of a blip in their sales during the last quarter. That was very much the kind of aerosols and personal care division, which is actually in rundown. So we did keep it on a buy because the rest of the business is doing okay. And I think I'd view it as more, they have been trading very strongly. It just seems this quarter was a bit of a blip, I would say, more than a longer term trend. Whereas Unilever, this is a longer term trend.
So the long-term trend being that developed markets are weakening quite substantially.
Yes. I mean, they're doing very well in and experiencing volume growth markedly up in the emerging markets, Unilever.
Mm.
But, yeah, developed markets bringing them down.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound great when a company like Unilever, which has become a stalwart of many, many investors' portfolios, is in trouble.
It's a bond proxy as well.
A bond proxy, exactly. Exactly. Which is just like the infrastructure stuff we're talking about
exactly,
too.
Yeah.
Oh, it's all kind of heading towards this, coalescing towards.
Unfortunately, everything is, and that's because of the QE bubble. So it's as long as it doesn't sort of drop down altogether at the same time, which is one of the worries.
Yeah, well, let's see what happens as they try to tighten in the months ahead, which is the subject of my editorial, actually. Alex, I know I haven't actually introduced Alex Newman, who's sitting over in the control room. But Alex, I mean, we've talked about outsourcing and how awful it is, but there is outsourcing in your sector, which is the oil and gas sector, generally in terms of the companies that are providing the rigs and the services that the likes of Shell and whoever need to go out and drill. And actually things are looking a bit brighter there.
I'd qualify that. It's looking brighter potentially for one company which we'll talk about this week, which is Hunting. It's looking brighter because they are largely exposed to the US onshore businesses. So the shale boom, they deliver perforated systems and various services to the shale drillers, which have been expanding at a probably unsustainable clip. They put out a trading statement this week where they said they're likely to return to a pre-tax profit this year. They've booked huge impairments and pre-tax losses for the last 2.5 years. And the shares, you know, consequently up about 10% as of yesterday. So you could take that as a sign that the sector is turning around. But the read across for most of the oil and gas services companies listed in London is not huge. We've got the likes of Wood Group, which merged with Amec Foster Wheeler. They've got heavy North Sea exposure. That's still in decline or flatlining. Gulf Marine Services, you know, they're slightly more focused on Middle East markets. Still a bit tepid there. So the read across is not exact, but you know, people are looking for any sign of an uptick in oil and gas services fortunes because they're so highly geared to the fortunes of the market. And for so long now, we've been thinking this is going
to
turn.
Are they geared to the oil price then, essentially?
Yes, in a slightly reactive sense. And obviously commissioning is only going to be done, or project commissioning is only going to be done when oil companies feel they have some sort of price stability. So there is an indirect link, and obviously oil companies are only going to drill if they think they're going to make money, so they're only going to commission oil and gas services companies if there are projects out there. So there is a link, but it can tend to lag certainly the share prices of the oil and gas suppliers and producers.
Okay, I mean, it is interesting. You have actually tipped in this week's issue an oil services company.
Yes, right. So,
this would seem a very contrarian view.
Yeah,
and so it's a very new company as well to the market, that is.
Yeah, so I can understand how you know, obviously, I've given the impression of slightly.
You're just teasing us, Alex.
Yes, yeah. So, the company we've tipped this week, I won't mention their name, you can buy the magazine, but they have a very, very specific business niche. They have been benefiting from the distress in the sector of over the last 5 years, and been buying up on the cheap jack-up rigs in the Middle East from companies who have either gone insolvent or gone under and need to pass on their contracts.
And has there been a lot of insolvency in this sector?
Yeah, there has. So I think the likes of Seadrill, I think they're huge in this area, and they had to take some bankruptcy protection last month, I believe. Lots of smaller companies which might have one or two rigs, and when things turn sour, they have fewer capital resources to draw on. So this company, which we talk about, has a very differentiated, innovative model. They've got a really good management team. They're also, I've pretty much given away all the details you can find out about the company. But
right. They still don't tell them who it is.
Sure. they're based in Egypt, so they have a very, very low cost base, and they've got excellent working relationships with the oil majors. So
it's like through the keyhole or something.
But you can read about the one extra sentence of detail that I haven't mentioned there in the magazine.
Excellent. But, thank you, Alex. Before we head over to Simon Thompson, and before we hear from James on infrastructure, let's talk about banking before we leave you alone, Emma. We've had a couple of interesting bits of news this week. Lloyds, Barclays today, which is obviously not in the magazine, and Metro Bank.
Yes, exactly. All live tips, in fact. So maybe we should start with Lloyds.
Yeah, let's start with Lloyds, because that's the big one. I suspect many people will own Lloyds shares.
Yes, very widely held. Yes, Lloyds, quite a positive update, actually. They're up about 2% yesterday.
The most positive aspect of the update being that PPI is essentially over for them.
Well, it's never over.
No.
I mean, it will be over one day.
I don't know, it's because Arnold Schwarzenegger's head said
exactly,
so.
Literally. They didn't have to take any provisions, so that was good news for them. Also, their capital generation, they've upgraded their forecasts, which is for the year, which is obviously great news because Lloyds does have that good dividend. So that's great in terms of backing the dividend. It's
so that would suggest, I mean, you say great dividend, it's returning...
It's returning. But I mean, they're delivering on what they said they would do.
And more importantly, do they have the potential to keep returning?
Yes.
Decent dividend growth to investors.
Yeah, they've got a target of about 13% in terms of their equity rate, their capital ratio. They're on about 14.1%. That increased again during the quarter. That's why we've kind of stuck with them. Their shares are up on the tip.
Yeah, bit of a slow burn, but getting there.
It's a slow burn, but I mean, this is the UK banking sector.
Let's talk Barclays, because that wasn't so positive.
Barclays, not so positive. So that was mainly due to its markets business. Lower income there. It missed kind of consensus expectations on income and pre-tax profits.
So when you say it's markets business, you mean like the investment banking?
So it's investment banking operations, which unsurprisingly are more volatile than just sticking with UK retail banking, which obviously is what some people thought they should do, but they decided to
keep
with the investment banking side.
Indeed, there was a big old power struggle over that.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
You look at Lloyds versus Barclays, and perhaps the retail banking route was the one to go for. But hey, there you go. Funny enough, my missus has just dumped her bank account with Barclays in favour of Metro Bank. Let's talk about their updates.
Yes.
I'm tempted to go the same route. I do like Metro Bank.
Do you know what I always say? I don't know whether I can say this, but as a customer, I think they would look good. I'm not with them. I'm just saying they would look good. I can see why people bank with them. They focus on customer service. They have these branches, or as they call them, stores.
They're a branch
that are open until about 8 p.m. I mean,
that's
brilliant.
That's really useful.
They're open on the weekends.
That's really
you can bring your
too.
Dog in.
Open on Sundays.
Yes, exactly. They're very good. But that this is also the point. This is the point why they're a live sell tip, is that this all costs a lot of money and their costs are rising. And in fact, during the third quarter, yes, they increased their loan book and yes, they increased their income. But at the same time, their operating expenses were higher than their net interest income. So,
but isn't this just like a growth business, though? Isn't that fine while a company is in expansionary mood?
But the issue is, okay, they're really focused on UK retail banking, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But I think if consumer confidence starts to waver, which it has in the UK, I would say.
Oh, which is reflected, I would suggest, in the profit warning from Pendragon, which we haven't talked about.
Yes.
So we have talked a lot about cars recently, we'll avoid that subject. The car market is basically not in a good place.
But it's growing and spending. So I just think it's a very high-risk strategy. And also the shares are... I think they're over 3x forecast net tangible assets, which is at the very, very top of the sector. I mean, Lloyds is 1.2.
Right. So they're expensive. But they're a growth bank.
Risky. I think it's going to come unstuck.
You've spoken to them. You've had them in the studio.
I have.
So, it's a view. That's what makes a market. Exactly. I think, as I say, the customer experience is good.
As a customer, I just wouldn't buy the shares.
No. But then what you're suggesting is that they will run into a point where they have to basically, a bit like the outsource and service degradation, they will have to cut back on some of the things that differentiate them, and they just become another bank.
Yeah.
Is that the concern?
Well, that is part of the concern. I mean, Craig Donaldson has said, well, we can't compete on rates, obviously, because rates are so low.
Rates are decent. In terms of
it's not a real differentiator for them. So the only way they can...
You would be amazed. I think people eke out those small differences in savings rates. They really do.
Perhaps,
I think it does become a differentiator.
Perhaps. But I just don't see... I think that, they're spending so much money because they have to differentiate their customer experience. And they're just so expensive.
I think that's a perfectly reasonable view. Okay, thank you, Emma. James, let's quickly turn to the cover feature. I mean, we've dropped some hefty hints as to where we might be going with this, but let's talk very quickly about infrastructure before we head over to Kent and Simon Thompson on the phones. James, infrastructure. I mean, we've written a lot about these companies that offer exposure, generally speaking, investment trusts that offer exposure to infrastructure. Roads, rail, power, anything like that, which is essentially the fabric of the kind of arteries of the world, as it were. But what you've done this week is actually looked at it in a portfolio sense to understand why you should have this and what you should look out for when you put it in your portfolio.
Well, the reason you'd have infrastructure, we're in a low interest rate environment. There's no real risk-free rate of return for long income, for income matching reasons in your portfolio. You can't get a good return on bonds, cash is negative real return. And we're also looking in terms of portfolios, there's the risk of, as Bearball put in his column this week, there's negative correlations between equities and bonds that people have relied upon for diversification in portfolios. There's a real danger that those could have vanished in the way that the current bubble has been inflated. Everything's gone up in price.
Well, what does he call it? The bull market and everything.
Yeah.
So basically, correlations as we used to see them have broken down. I think that's fairly widely accepted. Therefore, you have to look into more unusual places to get the assets that do the things you need to do in your portfolio.
The first thing to say is that investing infrastructure is still done through listed vehicles. So there are some managed funds which invest in listed infrastructure. So companies which meet a very tight definition of infrastructure, or investment trusts, as you say. So there is still volatility beta risk. But what there has there's a chart in the feature where we show that the volatility of infrastructure, listed infrastructure, is less than the MSCI world. So it's sort of a sub asset class in terms of your accessibility as a private investor, but it's a less volatile one,
which is good.
And where it does give you something different is in reliable inflation linked cash flows, so you can be more sure of a growing dividend than you can investing in, say, the bond proxy. So we spoke about Unilever maybe running into trouble. A lot of people have gone very heavy into utilities, those do have good ability to generate money, but do they have any more ability to grow a dividend if inflation rises?
I have some utilities. I have Centrica. It's a disastrous, awful investment.
So the idea is there are more diverse ways to invest in infrastructure than the way a lot of people would have done it, which is just buy a UK utility stock.
Yeah. So what's the answer? What are we looking at? I mean, there are essentially four listed trusts that you've looked at in this feature that are largely UK-centric?
Largely UK-centric, and there's a new managed fund that was launched by M&G Invest, which is a global infrastructure fund.
Which you quite like.
I do like it. It's got a good, broad... It's very international, good exposure to North America, which means you've got the benefit of some currency exposure there, overseas currency earning exposure. And it's something where, so looking at the infrastructure of the world, we've got airports, toll roads, which in North America actually have the ability to generate revenue with different sort of pricing of lanes. You have so there's three classes of infrastructure: economic, which would be the traditional things, utilities, transport, that sort of thing, and then you've got social infrastructure, which is a bit more controversial. This is where there's the political risk that comes with investing in infrastructure. Which,
schools and hospitals, are we talking?
Yeah, schools, hospitals, university accommodation, the type of thing that I think would come into the sights of a Labour government under Corbyn and McDonnell.
Is this something that we should genuinely be mindful of?
Well, I think yes, we should, because look, we've got a wafer thin majority for the current Conservative government. Bare working majority, a very slim mandate. They're trying to deliver the hand grenade of Brexit. If they pull the pin on that, then we're in a situation where we could have a general election. I don't think the public wants another election, but we might be forced to have one. And in that situation, I mean, I think you what Jeremy Corbyn's shown, you underestimate him at his peril.
Yeah, indeed. So I guess what that raises the point of is that whilst we talk about infrastructure investments having lower volatility than equities, that there are still risks that you need to be mindful of.
They go a long way out, the infrastructure. So you your cash flows go further out. You have a lot of different projects being added to a trust. So the advantage of the UK investment trusts is a lot of them are priced at a premium, but it's different to other investment trusts, say, because they're adding new projects all the time, and so it's not, you would normally, when you would value an equity, you'd do a sort of a discounted cash flow model, looking at the time value of money, net present value, all
so
of that stuff.
So they're making new investments.
When you've got new investments bringing on new, reliable, government-backed, inflation-linked cash flows, they almost go out in perpetuity. So it's more like a bond.
And presumably, if there is some kind of political shift in any given country that they're investing in, they can readjust their strategy for new investments.
Yes, you can, and it's with the a lot of the UK ITs are still very UK centric though, and so we noticed that the price drops on things like HICL, which is very UK centric, has a lot of PFI contracts, investing in things like schools and hospitals. That the price fell on that a bit more after the Labour conference than on some of the others, which are a bit more diverse or invested in less sensitive, politically sensitive projects. Anything invested in hospitals or schools is very much likely that on ideological grounds a Labour government would want to bring that in.
So you actually have to dig under the skin of these trusts when you decide that you want some infrastructure in your portfolio. You've actually usefully put a table together which shows the exposure of the main four.
I borrowed it off of Canaccord Genuity.
Thank you, Canaccord Genuity.
Yeah, so they show the main investment exposure of those four main listed trusts. Which
it does lead you to the question though: should we be looking for trusts that do have a more global remit, or trusts or funds or whatever you know? Because I think the M&G fund is a fund.
The M&G fund
trust
is global. I like that one a lot because it's so its biggest exposure is in North America, so US and Canada, where they have a very benign regulatory backdrop for infrastructure investment.
You mentioned the feature, things like data centres, for example, are considered infrastructure.
Well, exactly.
That's quite interesting.
So it's emerging infrastructure. And also, really, what these funds all tend to do is to invest in up-and-running projects. We're not talking about investing in the early stages. That's high risk. I mean, you get sovereign wealth funds and pension funds will provide the capital for that. Sometimes, giving governments very poor deals, as happened with Hinkley Point in the UK.
Yeah,
but again, nuclear, we can take off the table because no fund marketed at private investors would touch that with a barge pole.
Mm. Thank you, James. That's fascinating. Talking of infrastructure, did you see, Alex, over in the control room, the news that Saudi Arabia is essentially going to build an enormous
city?
It's called Neom.
What's it called?
Neom.
Tell us about this. This sounds mad.
I don't know too much.
City of the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen in the Gulf a number of attempts in the past to build a brand new city, which hasn't quite come to fruition.
They have been quite successful. I mean, the Emirates, for example, you know, Dubai, Abu Dhabi. It's pretty successful.
With the exception of the major financial capitals, I mean, the Neom ambition, I think it sits very close to the border with Jordan.
And Egypt. It's right. I think it's on the three of them.
Yeah. So this is, and this is, I think there was a 500 billion. I mean, I kind of give up on the price tags which are attached to Saudi grand ambition. But that's the ambition anyway, as part of Mohammed bin Salman, the deputy crown prince's ambition to turn Saudi Arabia into a modern economy and away from oil.
Is that what it is?
It's part of that. So, you know, the advertising that's accompanied the launch of it this week, it looks like a normal tourist destination in the Middle East rather than Saudi Arabia is not normally known for somewhere where, you know, it's necessarily easy to do business or move your family to or you know, take a beach holiday to. That's part of the grand ambition, but they're holding
this. Open up?
Yeah, it looks like it's opening up, and you know they're very, very keen for inward investment. You know, the Saudi Aramco saga rolls on.
Is it related to the Saudi Aramco saga, would you say?
They all tie to the broader theme of trying to kickstart other areas of the Saudi economy. So they have a lot of money, but they are very conscious, I think, that the sources of this money are going to potentially run dry over the next 30 years. And the oil price shock of the last 3 years has been the big wake-up call to that.
It sounds quite progressive, almost, which is not a word you would usually associate with Saudi Arabia.
It does. I mean, I saw an interview with MBS, as he's known, in The Guardian. And, I mean, some of the comments he was making about wanting to effectively liberalise Saudi society, I mean, I'd wonder how those go down with the clerics within Saudi Arabia. And that's confrontation, which potentially a powder keg in the region. But I mean, his grip on power is consolidating. So, you know, remains to be seen. It's fascinating, but it's a big, big plan at the moment. I think we've got videos and big conferences. We'll wait to see if these actually turn into something a bit more concrete.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
I think we need to come back. We'll have to have another look at this
sure.
one at some point in the future. Okay. Thank you, James. Thank you, Alex. And now we're going to head over to Simon Thompson on the phones. How are you doing, Simon?
I'm doing well. Had a cracking week this week, John. Another six companies in-depth analysis, two in the magazine columns, four on the website. Two major share breakouts backed by a raft of contract wins for two of the companies that I'm going to talk about, one of which is BATM Advanced Communications, one
Batman.
Of my bargain shares. Batman, exactly. One of my bargain shares 2017 did nothing in the first 6 months for the portfolio. Stock price stuck around 18, 19 pence, the entry point. When I interviewed the chief executive back in August and published an article at the time, he said that the company was in running for some major orders. He wasn't kidding. They've just landed the network and cyber division, a $36 million contract with an agency of a government defense department for the monitoring of suspicious network activity and threats. It's got proof of concept trials in multiple countries with other companies stroke countries as well, and a lot of those are expected to be delivered on. And that's just, you know, scratching the surface. It's also got a really I got really excited about this. It's got a diagnostic business, which I hadn't really delved too much into when I advised buying the shares. It's called Ador. It's with a Netherlands-based private group, Gamida. And what they've done is Gamida, 7 years ago, paid over $25 million for all the microarray assets connected to Nanogen. It was a US biotech firm that went bust, basically. And they're using that technology to develop a screening process for hospital-acquired infections like MRSA and C. diff. And to identify tropical infections in travelers returning back from holiday with fevers. They've already validated it. The first four machines will be installed in European hospitals by the end of the first half of next year. 10 more are in the process of being built for customers in Europe and Israel. US launch is planned for next year. It's protected by 40 patents, so it's completely IP-proof. And this has got a competitive...
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Advantage over anything else in the market. The benchtop analyzer can probe 100 targets in a single carbon array, whereas current products on the market only probe an average 4 to 6 targets. I reckon one of the big players like Roche Diagnostics, once this is actually up and running in the hospitals, have actually, you know, taken the systems on board and actually proved it. I think one of the big players is going to come in and buy this.
You think so? I mean, Batman has been around for years. I used to cover this, God, 18 years ago, near enough. And I think the chief executive is still the same guy.
Same guy, and but I mean that's just one of its medical diagnostic businesses. It's got another one that's Adaltis, an Italian manufacturer of diagnostic equipment. Well, they sold a 5% stake in that to this Chinese company, which basically places a value in the business of 44 million quid.
Well, what they might do is build up these businesses and then sell them as a bit of the business rather than
exactly,
the whole company.
Exactly.
Right, gotcha.
And so, I mean, BATM at the moment has got 15% of its market cap of 100 million quid in cash, so roughly 50 million quid in cash. I've done some of the parts valuations on it, and I come out roughly 30 to 33 pence minimum. I put the readers back in at 19 pence in February. Interestingly, for the last 6 years, the share price was stuck in a range between 13 and 21. Well, it just burst out above that 21 resistance level this week. It's now 24 pence in the market. I rate this a buy.
Excellent. And plenty of upside, presumably, as well.
Oh, yeah. To 24 pence offer price in the market today, minimum 30 to 33 pence is my target price. So we're looking upwards of 25 to 33% upside,
and that obviously doesn't take into account the very, very bright prospects for this technology over the much, much longer term.
Oh yeah, I can see a number of further contracts, both for the diagnostics division plus the cybersecurity business, coming in the coming months. So, I mean, that's going to be positive news flow. The other one that actually caught my eye was Sisys.
Another company that's been around seemingly for donkey's years.
Well, this listed on AIM back in 1997. It was then known as Codecisis.
Codecisis, wasn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. And about 10 years ago, they sold the Coda part of the business, returned £160 million back to shareholders, and that left them with basically a business focused on the space, defence and commercial sectors, providing bespoke software systems. What interested me was that about 3 weeks ago, I had the whole board on the telephone for about 50, 60 minutes. And during that conversation, the finance director told me that the company's bid pipeline was better than any we have seen before.
So what sort of work are they bidding on?
Well, for example, they've got two contracts with the European Space Agency to deliver software for mission management and control software. That's the Galileo satellite navigation program.
Mm-hmm.
They've just won a contract this week, which is why the share price has taken off, €18 million for the German National Satellite Communication Mission, Heinrich Hertz. That's deliverable over the next 3 years and basically will underpin a chunk of FinCap's forecasts, which point to next year earnings rising by about 10%, about 11 pence a share. This share price in the market is about 124 pence.
I mean, it does beg a question, though, Simon. You know, they are, when you talk about space exploration in a European context, it is European projects. It's EU projects. We don't really have a space agency of our own. There has been a lot of talk that contracts will not be awarded to British suppliers, and yet this seems to be the opposite of that.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I had the chief executive and finance director, and I grilled them on this, and they said, look, we've been part of these European Space Agency programs for the best part of 20 years. They're happy with us. We're a prime contractor for parts of these programs. The monetary terms in terms of the whole program, it's not a huge amount, but it's still, you know, £5 million contract they've just won for the European Space Agency. So it's, you know, it's, in terms of the small cap companies, it's quite significant. I mean, they also have a broadcast business, so they've got a massive contract with the BBC, which basically involves the rollout of software to automate the newsroom process. So it enables, so for example, if you're watching a programme, BBC News, then simultaneously you can be seeing things on the website, BBC website, which is actually feeding off those news bulletins. And it's actually their software that does that. And they've got this massive contract with the BBC, which, and that's just one organization. They've got others with RTL and major German broadcasters. So, I mean, it's not a one-trick pony, but the interesting thing here is I put the readers in early October about 102 pence or thereabouts, and you could easily buy around that level. They didn't really move, but they certainly moved this week after these contracts came in. It's burst through, the share price has burst through a 11-year high of 118. It's about 124 pence at the moment. My target price is 155, so another 25% upside. In terms of the earnings, it's rated currently about 11 times earnings estimates for 2018, 1.6 times book value, dividend yield roughly 2%. It's not expensive. And I just expect more of these contracts to be landed.
Okay. Well, it's good to have some good news, Simon, because the rest of the podcast was talking about profit warnings. So thank you very much, and have a great weekend, even though it's only Thursday. Speak to you soon.
We'll do. Well, have an early weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be nice. Anyway, thanks, Simon. Speak soon.
Cheers.
See you later.
Bye.
Okay, and there we have it. Lots in the issue. And I tell you, we've hardly scratched the surface of what we've got in the magazine this week. As I said, we've got James's feature, but we also have Phil Oakley's feature on how to identify safe high yielders. We've got Philip Ryland returning to his 50 Object series to round that up with some very interesting financial history there. Loads in the personal finance and funds section, which they will be talking about on their podcast tomorrow. Not least the idea of inflation protection as we suffer the consequences of voting to leave the European Union temporarily. Lots in the tip section. We even got some results this week. It's as I say, a jam-packed issue. We've discussed some of it, but to find out more, you'll have to pick up the magazine. Building the World, £4.90 in all good news agents. Or get online and subscribe. Thank you for listening. Speak soon.